Thank you for joining us here today at Calvary Church, where we are committed to loving God and loving people. If you have any questions or want to learn more about who we are, visit us online at calvary.ca. Now let's check out this week's message.
Hello, Calvary Church. Welcome to our continuation of the Miracles of Jesus, our series that we've been in as we head towards Easter, to the greatest miracle of them all. And so today we have a guest speaker, a good friend, the doctor is in the house. So today I want you to welcome Dr. David McDonald, who many of you know, I guess about 17 years ago, used to be on the pastoral team here at the church, our late bishop and pastor emeritus. His dad was the pastor here, senior pastor for many years. His mom and family still attend the church, and so we love Dave, and we're so glad that he's with us today. He's living in Michigan right now with his family, and he's making some changes in his ministry. He's been the lead pastor at Westwinds Church there for about that length of time, almost 17 years, and now is making an exciting change as he helps and brings strength to church pastors and leaders, and so he's going to tell us a little bit more about that. So welcome today, Dr. David McDonald.
We know that Jesus was really close with his cousin, John the Baptist. In fact, there's a pretty sizable minority of scholars who posit that Jesus may have been one of John's followers, right up to and even including the moment when Jesus was baptized by John. And at that baptism, sort of their rules reversed. That's when John acknowledged Jesus was greater. That's when the heavens open up, a dove appears, and we hear the divine voice saying, "This is my son, with whom I am well pleased." Now we know they were close. I mean, Jesus and John, they were friends, they were companions, their families were close. Even their two mothers spent a ton of time together. Like in Luke chapter 1, we're told they visited each other during their pregnancies. I mean, they were related. And in that world at that time, that relationship mattered. So consequently, when Jesus learns about John's death at the hands of King Herod, he's a wreck, man. He's emotional. He's grieving. He's sad. And if you've ever lost somebody that you're close to, you know what that's like. And you need a second. You need to be by yourself. And so that's what Jesus did. He was fully God, sure, but he was also fully human. So he went off to be by himself. He just needed space to process all that happened. But he didn't get it. I mean, Jesus being Jesus means that everybody was on him all the time. They were following him everywhere. And as something of a public figure myself, I can tell you, that's frustrating, man. That's why people talk to you at the urinal. That's why people follow you into the change room. That's why, in my case, sometimes people will look in my window from outside. It's crazy. And this is the background of Matthew 14. Jesus is out there grieving for his cousin, for his friend, his longtime companion, but the crowd wouldn't leave him alone. Check it out here in Matthew 14, verse 13. When Jesus heard what had happened to John, he withdrew by a boat privately to a solitary place. Now, that word solitary place in Greek is the word desert. We're supposed to think about the Sinai Desert. We have this sort of echo of wandering and wilderness and desolation. Now, hearing this, the crowds followed Jesus on foot from the town. And when Jesus landed on the shore, he saw this huge crowd. He had compassion on them, and he began to heal their sick. Now, he did this all day, and as evening approached, the disciples came to him and they said, "This is a really remote place, and it's getting late. Maybe send the crowds away so they can go to the villages and buy themselves some food." But Jesus said, "They don't need to go away. You give them something to eat." "We only have like 5 loaves and a couple fish," they answered. "Well, bring them here to me," Jesus replied. And then Jesus directed the people to sit down on the grass. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and he gave thanks and he broke the loaves. Now, this formula of taking and blessing and breaking and giving is really common among Jewish meals. In fact, it's the basis for our Eucharistic celebration. It's how Christians first started to celebrate communion. And there's this sort of familial identity to it. You know, this is what a dad would do at the Passover meal, or maybe what your dad would do at Thanksgiving. So Jesus takes it, breaks it, blesses it, gives it, and then he gives it to the disciples. The disciples gave it to the people, and everybody ate, and they were all satisfied. The disciples went around, picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over, and The number of the people who ate was about 5,000 beside women and children. So the total number of people at this miracle would have been way larger than 5,000, maybe 3 to 5 times as many. It's just kind of one of those things of the ancient world where they only count men. Shame on them. Now, I want you to know that this miracle story is less about something that happened than it is about something that happens. It's a historical episode. I mean, it describes a miraculous moment where Christ blows everybody's minds. But it's also more than that. It's more than that. It's indicative of how God works. I mean, first, consider there's a bunch of Old Testament precedents for this episode. Like Elijah multiplied oil and bread for a widow to make sure that she and her son wouldn't starve. And then that his disciple, Elisha, well, he did the same kind of thing, except he provided food for 100 people with only 20 loaves of bread, showing that Elisha was more powerful than his master. Now, if Elisha's miracle demonstrated his superiority, how much more does Jesus' miracle demonstrate his? And what about Moses, who led all the people of God through the wilderness, you know, feeding them with manna from heaven? That's why the notice of a wilderness is so important earlier. He's like, isn't the food that Jesus provides so much more abundant, so much more spectacular than Moses? It's almost like Jesus is reminding us through his miracles that everything he does, that everything he's going to do, everything is meant to liberate us and bless us and redeem us forever. Now, these loaves probably would have been made of barley, which is the grain, the first grain to be harvested in the spring. And so the Feast of Unleavened Bread celebrates the first fruits of the barley harvest. So Jesus performs this miracle as Passover approaches. He'll go on later to talk in John 6 about the fact that he's the bread of life. So the miracle of the loaves points backwards to great events in the Old Testament to give us a clue about who Jesus is, but it also points forward to the future. Because God always points forward to the future, to what Jesus is going to do in the upper room on the night before he dies. And again, the way we relive all that through the Eucharist. I mean, these people recline where there's a lot of grass, these verdant pastures that remind us of Psalm 23. We think about Jesus being the good shepherd after giving thanks and feeding them with rich fare that causes their cup to run over with blessings, not only of earthly satisfaction, but eternal life. I mean, all this stuff, this imagery, this passion reminds us of the scriptures that have happened before and are going to happen again. Like Isaiah 25 says that on this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all people a feast. Feast. So again, this isn't just a story about something that happened, but about something that happens and happens still. God is still in the business of miracles. In fact, biblical scholar Craig Keener, in this massive 2-volume work called Miracles, describes over 24 historical instances of food being supernaturally multiplied since the time of Christ. And some of these things are like milk replenishing in cans, vitamins multiplying for prisoners in concentration camps, several instances of food growing in soup kitchens for the poor, because again and again and again, God wants you and I to know that he's in the business of miracles. God still provides. God still sees you, sees what you need, and acts decisively to bless you, to heal you, to redeem you, and to restore you. So you might be looking at your life wondering, oh my Lord, is there any hope? Yes, there's always hope. There's always hope for the people who trust in God. That's why Eugene Peterson tells us in his translation of Romans that he is the God of green hope, ever green, ever ready to help his people. So we can trust Jesus with what we need. He was motivated by compassion. Even when he needed rest and solitude, he made sure that his needs were subservient to the needs of others. So when the disciples come to him and they're concerned for the well-being of the people, Jesus responds. I think it's funny. The Synoptic Gospels make it clear that Jesus wasn't really concerned that they were hungry. Now, Jesus was concerned that their hunger would drive them away from his teaching. Because Jesus is more concerned with our ignorance than our appetite, which I think we do well to remember when we're, you know, lonely, tired, poor, and sad. Christ looks at us and he knows that what we need is wisdom and insight, understanding and knowledge. And it's his compassion that then provides food and shelter and friendship and money in order to ensure we don't scatter to find those things on our own through lesser means. Now, there's some really cool stuff, I think, that is significant in this passage, but before we really get into it, I want to draw your attention to one other juxtaposition, and that's the contrast between Jesus' feast and Herod's feast. See, Herod's feast, where John the Baptist was beheaded, was everything the world could desire. It was lavish and opulent, representing the very best of food and festivities, but at the core, Herod's feast was rotten. The menu was pride, arrogance, murder, and betrayal. Any royalty they possessed would have been reduced to the petty whims of a despot. But The Jesus feast, in contrast, was everything the world could never imagine. I mean, despite the lack of provisions in Jesus' feast, nobody went hungry. In fact, there were tons of leftovers, demonstrating the proclivity of God to provide super abundantly for everybody. Jesus' menu was highlighted with compassion and wisdom, a healthy dash of healing for dessert. Now, everybody who came to Herod's feast knew exactly what they would get, except maybe John the Baptist, but everybody who came to Jesus' feast got what they required, what they needed. So this is a lesson to you and me, man, a lesson within a lesson. Don't settle for the wealth and the pomp of the world, because the first will be last. The last will be first. The greatest will be like a servant. Those who are humble will be exalted, and even the one who loves his life is going to have to lose it. See, the feast of Christ's kingdom is an alternative everything the world promises, but can never supply. And you and me, we're going to get to feast with Christ forever. Now, a couple things to remember. This feeding of the multitudes teaches that, first of all, we never have what it takes. We don't. We don't ever have enough. We're not ever enough. We're not smart enough. We're not wise enough. We're not shrewd enough. But God delights in using what we have. God always leaves some of the work for us, which I think is hilarious. That's number three. So we never have what it takes. God delights in using what we have, and God always leaves some of the work for us. I mean, think about it. He's a God of participation. He's a God of self-actualization. I mean, he looks at you and he goes, come on, let's get to work, man. You may not have everything, but I do. But let's start with what you have. You got a little bit of wisdom. You got a sense of humor. You got insight. You got a little business acumen. You got some skills. You got some relationships. Great. Let's start there. Let's start with what you got. It's kind of like, when your kids were little, if you have kids. We live in Michigan. There's tons of snow here. It's a frozen wasteland. And you take your kids for a walk in the woods. And you come up to a big hill, and the kids would start to slip on the hill, and they couldn't quite make up the hill, you know, when they were little. Well, as a dad, I would always hold on to my kid's hand and help them get up the hill, you know, step by step. But if my kid ever just, like, threw themselves on the ground and started tantruming and pounding their feet, hands back and forth, well, then I didn't want to help them at all. I think God is the same way. He's going, look, I know that you don't have what it takes to get up this hill. I'm going to help you. I'm not going to do everything for you. He didn't do everything for the disciples in this miracle. He said, you go feed them. The disciples had to take the fish. The disciples had to take the bread. The disciples had to pass it out. The disciples had to gather it up. I mean, this was their thing in cooperation with God. Jesus didn't pass out the food. Jesus didn't clean up the baskets. Jesus isn't going to do everything for you. He's just going to do some of the major things that you're incapable of doing. But the work is ours, man. We cooperate with God. We participate with God. And I think sometimes God looks at us, he looks down, you know, from up in heaven, wherever that is, and he goes, man, this is going to be great. I can't wait to see what Calvary Christian Church does once I get them started. I can't wait to see what this family does once I get them started. I can't wait to see what this person does once I get them started. And the thing that we got to remember is that we can't just look at all the obstacles. Oh, we don't have enough food. Oh, we don't have enough people. Oh, we don't have enough resources. No, no, no. We got to look at the needs. We got to look at the problems. We got to look at the opportunities. And when we see all those needs and problems and opportunities, the Spirit of God speaks to us and tells us, man, you got to respond. And when we do, we have to respond to the world as we see it. And don't look at the fact that you don't have the resources. And don't look at the fact that you don't have all the reserves that are required to make this thing happen. Man, God will help you. You just got to start by looking at the world around going, Lord, I think I see a problem. I think I'm supposed to be involved in the solution. And of course, many of you know that this has been the story of my life these last couple or 3 years. This January, I stepped away from local church ministry after being a pastor for 27 years, and I became full-time a missionary to pastors. And if you're unfamiliar with the story, I had been training pastors for probably about 15 years through seminaries and as a coach and a consultant. And man, I would see the needs that pastors have for great resources, for great insights, for great coaching. And I realized that they just weren't getting a lot of those needs taken care of through the normal ways. And in particular, when people would look at pastors, especially from the outside, if they didn't have a background in pastoral ministry, they look at pastors and they think, man, I think what these people need is rest. My pastor is tired. He needs time away to rest and to pray. Oh, my pastor's discouraged. He needs time away to, you know, sort of rejuvenate through inactivity. You maybe go walk in the woods or get outside in nature. But I can tell you, man, both from the research that I've done into it and from personal experience, rest does not rejuvenate pastors. Not like that. And so I began to see this huge need and this big problem that the people trying to rejuvenate pastors were going about it the wrong way. The pastors were in major difficulty and frustration, especially during the pandemic. I mean, do you know the United States that we lost 29% of all our pastors in 2020? I mean, those are from mostly small churches, but I mean, just pastors were by and large dropping like flies because nobody was helping. And I began to realize, like, God, I think you're calling me to help. I don't know how. I have no loaves and I have no fish. I have no money. I don't have a denominational support. I'm a lone ranger. How can I possibly help these pastors? But I started listening to my old sermons. You know, I started listening to stories like this one. And I realized, you know, I've got an opportunity to do something and go out on a limb, go out on a big step of faith. And so what we did was we bought this old, decrepit Victorian mansion. And we renovated it into a headquarters for pastors. Not where they could just come and rest, they get rest, but more importantly, where they could come and dream, where they could hear from God, where they could get around other pastors and energetically share their hopes for the future of the church. And 3 years since we've been open, as we know, we started before I stepped away from pastoral ministry. 3 years since we've been open, we've had 424 pastors come through the chapter house, the Fasari's chapter house, we call it. And I look back and I go, man, it's a miracle. That's a miracle. Because that's what God does. That's not just what God did. No, this miracle isn't something that happened. This miracle of provision and abundance, this miracle of hope and passion and enthusiasm, this is a miracle that still happens now. So friends, you might look around at your life and maybe God's not calling you to coach pastors or put life back into them. And maybe God's not calling you to feed a bunch of people with fish and loaves either, but you're going to look around at your life and you're going to see needs. You're going to perceive huge problems in your family, in your community, in the world around you. And you're going to perceive opportunity and you're going to go, oh my gosh, what am I supposed to do with all these things that I see? I don't have the resources. I don't have the reserves. I don't even know how to get started. Well, great. Great. You don't have to have it all. In fact, you never will. You're not going to have everything it takes. We never do. But God delights in using what we have. And when you're obedient and you step forward in faith and you say, okay, Lord, you break the fish, I'll pass it out. You break the bread, I'll pass it out. Then lo and behold, God shows up with divine resources to bless and to heal and restore through you, for you, because of you and because of your obedience. And lo and behold, you realize as you take a step of faith and another step of faith and another step of faith that God is using you as his response to a culture of fragmentation, loneliness, and despair, that God is working through you to heal the world, that you are the basket bringer, you are the fish deliverer, you are the people of faith, you are the apostles, you're the church. So God bless you, church. Go for it. Swing for the fences. Have an amazing time on this adventure of faith, serving our God who not only did miracles, but is doing them through you.